So, dann fange ich schon mal an. This talk was originally announced as being in English. Is there anyone who doesn't speak German? All right, then I try to do it in English, if that's fine with the rest of you. The slides are in German. I apologize for that, but I talk more than is on the slides anyway. So I'll try to do it in English. No problem. There doesn't seem to be a herald for this talk, so I have to announce myself, I guess. My name is Bernd Sieker. I'm talking about autopilots in aviation and autopilots in cars, automated driving, autonomous driving, self-driving cars. What can go wrong with autopilots in airplanes? And what also can go wrong with autopilots or self-driving cars? We don't know a lot about that yet because there aren't that many, but there have been a lot of problems with autopilots in airplanes. Oh, sorry, it's rolling by itself. Okay, I'll start with this one, and I hope it doesn't go automatically. Now, you already know everything, so maybe you can go now because you've seen everything. So let me adjust this. Okay. Then let's start. This is a brief outline. Most of you, I guess, can read German. So I'll talk about automation in means of transport generally. Mostly it will be airplanes and cars today. There's a lot of automation in trains. There are actually self-driving trains on some limited lines. Some Paris metro lines are completely driverless. And there's a Bay Area Rapid Transport in San Francisco, which is also driverless, has been for about 10 years or so. But today I'm not talking about trains, just planes and cars. I try to talk for about 45 minutes, and then there'll be 15 minutes for questions in the end, of which I hope there are many. All right, so automation, what's it about? There are different levels. The lowest level, of course, is we do all the driving or all the flying by ourselves. My car has hardly any automation. I think it has an anti-lock braking system, and it has electronic stability program, and it has cruise control, but a dumb cruise control, not an adaptive. So basically, I have to drive by myself. And most small airplanes are also hand-flown all the time. Then there's partial automation, in which the car does some things automatically, such as lane changes or adaptive cruise control, things like that. And then there's what the PR departments of the companies like to call autonomous driving or self-driving cars or driverless cars, cars which can perform some tasks autonomously, can, for example, drive on the highway for extended periods of time, but not in the city. So that's partial automation. And then there's the full automation. I guess some drones, some quadcopters can do fully autonomous flights, pre-programmed flights. Airplanes can fly a lot of a trip automatically, autonomously, but they are not really autonomous systems. The pilots always have to tell it quite specifically in some cases what to do. And of course, for cars, that's the ultimate dream, I guess. There's a driverless car that holds by your front door, stops by your front door. You get in, tell it where to go, and it will deliver you to another front door, completely without supervision and without intervention. So there are some differences in automation between airplanes and cars. The environment in which they operate is very different. For airplanes, the environment is very highly regulated. The airspace is very highly regulated. You can fly in some parts of the airspace. In some countries, you can fly almost freely. In other parts, you can only fly with clearance from air traffic control. So somehow the sound has changed. I don't know. Is it better or worse? Or it's better? Good. Thank you. Whereas for cars, the environment is almost uncontrolled. You can just get in your car and drive anywhere with few exceptions. If you like and have the car for it, you can even go off-road. Maintenance and operation for airplanes is also very highly regulated. For cars, it is quite different from country to country. There are some countries where it is hardly regulated at all, who can drive a car and who can repair it. In other countries, it is more highly regulated. In Germany, every car has to go to a technical checkup every 2 years. That is mandated by the government. And as far as training and education goes, the difference is similar again. It is very highly regulated for airplanes and somewhat regulated for cars. But once you have your driving license in most countries, you never need to take an exam again. And you can drive until you drop dead or whatever. And another thing is the automation in aircraft doesn't need to be super reliable because there are always pilots there. And it regularly does things wrong, drops out or arrives at the wrong altitude or busts the altitude, flies higher than intended, things like that, or just stops for any reason. Airplanes also never take off by themselves. The takeoff in an airplane is always done by the pilot. On the other hand, for cars, the requirements on reliability are extremely high if we're talking about higher levels of automation where the car basically drives itself and the driver is no longer necessary. But airplanes aren't there, and it doesn't seem like they're going towards full autonomy anytime soon. So I asked that on the Chaos Communication Congress a year and a half ago, are there any pilots here today? Private pilot, commercial pilot? Okay, ATP, I was asking. Single engine instrument, that's good, yeah. So when flying an airplane, there are usually three levels on which you can fly it. If you have an automated airplane without a pilot, you can fly manually, just moving the yoke or the stick. And you have just a simple autopilot. You just tell it to go into a certain direction or hold a certain altitude, and it will do that. And there's the so-called managed mode, where you can pre-program an entire flight with waypoints and altitude restrictions, and it'll do that. Then there are various automated subsystems, but it's the same in a car, basically. And some systems may come on automatically. The engine control is usually done by a digital computer these days in airplanes, as it is in cars. Another big difference is that a lot of the automation in airplanes depends very highly on external infrastructure. That is true to some extent for cars if they use GPS for navigation. But for airplanes, there's a lot of terrestrial infrastructure that is required, not only the airports, but radio beacons and instrument landing systems and things like that. So an autopilot doesn't really have any more information than the pilot. It doesn't decide anything. The pilot really tells the autopilot what to do, and then the autopilot basically moves the control surfaces and flies the airplane. And the autopilot also can never relieve the pilot of his responsibility. In an airplane, there's always exactly one pilot in command, and he bears ultimate responsibility for the safety of the flight, and he needs to do whatever is necessary to ensure the safety of all on board. And I don't see that commercial airliners are going to fly with less than two pilots anytime soon. I think some airlines would like to do it, but I don't think it's going to happen soon. There are some small commercial jets which can fly with a single pilot, even commercially with passengers, but over a certain size, and unless they have a special certification, they always have to be two pilots. Of course, there are a lot of advantages of automation. Automation can often react much quicker. In many cases, it does have more inputs, especially in cars. It will have infrared vision and radar and LiDAR and ultrasonic sensors. In airplanes, they usually don't have a lot more sensors. There's a weather radar, but that is usually not used for flight control or for the autopilot, but is only interpreted by the pilot. And of course, the autopilot can do monotonous tasks, such as just keeping the altitude and the course in cruise flight, which usually goes on for several hours without really anything to do. The autopilot cannot be distracted by most things. So I show you a brief video of some of the more impressive things, or one of the more impressive things that an autopilot does. And that is, let's see if I can get that full screen. I hope there'll be some sound. No, the sound is important.
Yeah, if you take this, then we take that.
And if you take it's not coming out of this one.
No, but if you switch it over to that, then...
Is that really the best way to do it?
I called Vuk and they didn't have... it should work the other thing, but it didn't. So.
Okay, I try this way. It's not super important, but it's quite interesting to hear, because you can hear the altitude call-outs from the flight warning computer. And that's the view out of the front window.
100, land 3. 50. 30. Slow brakes on.
Did you notice? The screen was only gray, but the video was actually running, and it counted down the altitude 50, 30, 20 feet above ground, and you could hear a touchdown before you could actually see the runway. And that's auto land, and that is something that human pilots can't do and are not allowed to do. Okay, I hope it's working now. So that's something. I imagine it's quite disconcerting, right, to look out the front window and not see anything and just feel it touch down. And you have to trust that the computer is going to do it right. One thing that can happen is if automated systems are too reliable, that the pilots or the drivers, as it may be, will come to rely on the automation. Imagine a car that doesn't fail on average for 100,000 kilometers. So you can drive several years and will never see a failure. And you come to believe that the automation is perfect. Until then, one day, it does have a failure and drops out and doesn't do what it's supposed to be, doesn't turn or whatever. And so it may actually be the case that quite unreliable automation is at the moment a lot safer than very reliable automation until we can get to extremely high reliability. So I don't know when that is going to happen. But this is perhaps one thing that has kept aviation so very safe, paradoxically, that the automation isn't foolproof. All pilots know that at any time the autopilot can drop out, can be turned off, and he has to hand fly the aircraft. In the automatic landing in low visibility that I just showed, the autopilot can drop out at any point. There's dual redundancy, which means if one autopilot drops out, you can still land. But if something else fails, if the instrument landing system, the ground beacon that guides the airplane down, fails, then the only thing the pilot is allowed to do is initiate a go around and take off again and not land. A human is not allowed to land in those conditions. That may change with modern artificial vision systems. Some business jets already have infrared vision systems that are superimposed on the windscreen, and they may use that as a backup system if the autopilot fails, but not as a primary system for landing. So it's never easy to get automation exactly right. And there are some cases in which mostly the automation did something that the pilot didn't expect and was surprised by it, or the human pilot made a small error, or there was a small technical system that didn't work as expected or as designed, and in some cases with catastrophic consequences. some of the design decisions that have to be taken when designing automation and cockpit systems is what needs to be done if things go wrong? And the first level is there a redundant subsystem that can take over? Airliners always have two autopilots, sometimes they have three independent computers. Fly-by-wire airliners have several, Airbus typically has seven flight control computers, a single one of which is sufficient to get the airplane safely back on the ground. So, with less comfort than if all of seven work, but it'll suffice to land, right? And the next fallback level is, of course, to hand back control to the human. And in airplanes, that happens frequently, so pilots know how to do it and know what to do and are frequently retrained at least every 6 months. I just read that Qantas does a checkup of their pilots 7 times a year, so they are very thorough in that. Another decision is if things go wrong, and if many things go wrong, which sometimes happens in aircraft and probably in cars too, the engineers, when designing the system, need to make the decision together with human interface experts and psychologists and all kinds of other people, which information to show to the pilot at what time. It may be that there are 30 or 40 error messages waiting in the queue, and during landing, you don't want to show all of them to the pilot, only the ones that he needs to know at that point. And that is a very tough decision to take when designing such a system, what to display at which point. And some things are important to know, some things less so. And I have a few stories about accidents that were caused by problems with the automatic thrust system. And they are very different systems. Boeing and most of the rest of the world have thrust levers that move with the automatic thrust control. So the computer decides to reduce thrust, and you can see the thrust levers moving back a bit. And Airbus in its fly-by-wire aircraft uses static thrust levers, which are not back-driven. So the pilot sets them to a certain position, which means automatic thrust control, and then the computer regulates the thrust and controls the thrust, but the thrust levers stay in the same position. So seems like a dumb idea, but we're not exactly sure. There have been accidents with both systems in which the system was involved. And here's one. Here's another video. In this one, the sound isn't important, so. But I try to get it full screen. So that is in Sao Paulo, Congonhas Airport. This is a normal landing, probably also an Airbus A320. And you notice it's slowing down. It's going pretty slow. And this one is the accident aircraft. And you immediately notice that it hasn't slowed down as it should. That's again the normal one. In the background, the one. I think it takes about 13 seconds or so to move through the picture. And this is the accident aircraft. And it takes about 3 seconds. And it didn't slow down, and it exited the end of the runway still going 100 knots. That's about 185 kilometers per hour. Shot over a big road, a 6-lane road, and crashed into a building next to a fuel station, and burned, and 200 people died. And what happened? This is an excerpt from the digital flight data recorder from the accident flight. And you can see these two lines are the left and the right thrust lever. And you can see that the pilot pulled one back. This is idle. And if you pull it further back, that's reverse thrust. And he pulled one back and put it into reverse thrust and let the other one sit in forward thrust. In normal forward thrust, the position where it is the entire flight. It has never been found out exactly why he did this. It may have to do something with a procedure that you had to use if one of the thrust reversers was broken and disabled, which was the case on this flight. It was deactivated. And the procedure was to pull both thrust levers to idle and select reverse only on the good reverser and not on the other one. What he actually did is maybe he remembered that, oh, use reverse thrust only on the good engine, and he forgot to pull the other thrust lever back entirely. So it had still significant forward thrust on one engine and reverse thrust on the other engine. And if, when not both thrust levers are in idle or in reverse, then various other automatic systems, such as the ground spoilers, which destroy lift and help break the aircraft at higher speeds, slow down the aircraft, and the automatic wheel brakes don't work. And it took the pilots 11 seconds to figure out that they weren't braking at all, neither aerodynamically nor with the wheel brakes. And that was far too late. If they had realized that immediately and used full manual braking on the wheel brakes, they might have probably just stopped on the runway. But this was a little thing that the pilot did, and the aircraft didn't really tell him what was going on. He noticed it didn't have any ground spoilers extending, but other than that, they were completely left in the dark about what was going on. So this is really basically what I already told you, just in German. So, and this had perhaps something to do with the static thrust levers, because just before touchdown, the computers reduce thrust to idle automatically, but the thrust levers stay in the forward position. And then on the Airbus, there's a call out that says retard, which means pull the thrust levers back, because we're not using forward thrust anymore anyway. So maybe in a system with moving thrust levers, this wouldn't have happened. But there are other cases. Here's another accident. It wasn't quite as catastrophic. It was only 9 dead. And in this case, there was also a small technical malfunction on the aircraft. One of the radar altimeters stopped working. And that radar altimeter is coupled to the automatic thrust control for landing, which means if it senses that the aircraft is lower than 27 feet above the ground, it reduces thrust to idle. And the malfunction in this case meant that the signal was reflected directly from the transmitter to the receiver. And so it indicated minus 8 feet. So the computer said, oh, we're below 27 feet, so reduce thrust to idle, while they were in fact still 200 feet high. So the pilots noticed, pushed the thrust levers forward again, but that doesn't disable the automatic thrust control. So the computers retarded the thrust levers again, this time unnoticed by the pilots. The speed decayed, they went into a stall, lost control, and crashed just a few hundred meters short of the runway. And in this particular case, while you can't say which of the system is actually a lot better or worse, this particular scenario wouldn't have happened with the Airbus-style thrust levers. So they would have just shoved them forward, and if you push them forward of the normal auto thrust position, you are in full manual thrust control. So it's really hard to say which system, if any, is better. They are just different. And here's another one, also to do with thrust control. And in that case, the automatic thrust was disabled and didn't turn itself back on, although the crew thought it would. So again, as in Amsterdam, speed decayed. They went into a full stall and crashed. One of the tragic side notes on this one is that one of the three people who were killed may actually have survived being ejected from the aircraft, but was then run over by a rescue vehicle. It is clear that she was run over by the rescue vehicle, but it's not quite clear if she was dead already or was killed by that additional accident. There was so much foam already covering everything, so the driver didn't see her. So what happened in these cases? In two cases, the aircraft had small technical defects. The one in San Francisco, was it San Francisco or Los Angeles? Not sure. Yeah, so the aircraft in that case was perfectly okay, and there were even 4 or 5 people in the cockpit, because some of the pilots were being checked out. But they didn't realize that the auto throttle didn't work as they thought it would. And maybe there's not enough training in some airlines. Maybe there's poor crew resource management, because one of the Czech pilots actually told the captain, the pilot in command, that the airspeed was lower than it should be. But there was no reaction, and when he finally pushed the thrust levers forward again to go around 5 seconds before the crash, it was too late to make a significant difference. I have a small side note here about pilots who did the wrong thing even when something major went technically wrong with the airplane. You probably all remember Captain Sullenberger, who ditched his Airbus A320 on the Hudson River after Canada Geese disabled both his engines. He completely lost thrust immediately after takeoff. Simulations later found that he might have been able to return to a solid runway, but equally likely, or maybe with some different probability, he would have crashed into a residential area. And so ditching on the Hudson River and saving everyone in the end turned out to be the right choice. And there's another one who was also rescued by good airmanship by the pilot. British Airways Flight 38 lost thrust on both engines on short final approach. And by excellent energy management with what he had left, retracting flaps one step, he managed to land on the airport, but not on the runway. It stopped just short of the runway, crash landed on the grass. And in this case too, everyone survived, a few people with injuries, but despite several tons of fuel spilling on the airport, there was no fire. If it had ignited, it would have looked very different, but in this case, everyone survived as well. Briefly talked about that, it's a hard decision for the engineers and designers what to show to the pilots. And the extreme case was Qantas Flight 32. Who remembers that? Yeah, of course, pilots will remember that. But an Airbus A380 from Qantas suffered what is called an uncontained engine failure. And if you read the report, it's actually very interesting to see the language there. One of the big compressor discs, or turbine discs, can't remember which, it's a big solid piece of metal to which the compressor or fan blades are attached. And some of them are as heavy as maybe 50 kilograms, so it's a really big piece of metal. And it says that the turbine disc was liberated. So it actually, at very high speed, broke apart, and three big chunks of it exited the engine. And they're basically like artillery projectiles. So really, they would go into the fuselage and exit the other side without noticeably slowing down. And it was very lucky that the cabin wasn't hit, so no one was hurt in this case. But the Airbus aircraft are very highly computerized, like any modern airliner, and for at least 50 minutes, one crew member was going through all the error messages about failed systems. And some pilot wrote that 21 of the 22 major systems had malfunctions on this aircraft. So hardly anything was working as it should. One engine couldn't be controlled anymore. There were fuel leaks. Electric control lines were severed. Hydraulic lines were severed. They basically lost half of all control surfaces. So it was still just flyable. But in the end, by going through all the error messages, the crew had a very good picture of what was still working, what the aircraft was still capable of. And so they managed to calculate the required landing distance and found that by manually recalculating the too conservative estimate of the computers, the required runway, that they could land with 100 meters to spare. So that's what they did. They had to approach very fast because a lot of the high lift devices weren't working, but in the end, they brought it down in one piece. or what was left of it. So we're still a long way away from that with cars. And it's also not very useful in a car to tell the driver what particular aspect of which particular specific subsystem has failed, because normal drivers aren't engineers and they wouldn't understand it anyway. But pilots need to have a very good engineering background to understand what the aircraft is doing. But even so, aircraft have automation only in a very limited way. It can do some things very well. It can land in no visibility. It can cruise along comfortably and very smoothly change altitude and things like that. But there always has to be a human monitoring the system, ready to take over whenever necessary. And it also can be disabled at any point. And but unlike cars in an airplane, there's usually a few seconds time. If the computer says, oh, I'm turning off the autopilot, the airplane isn't going to do anything if it's in cruise flight or so. It's just going to continue flying. And there's a bit of time, and there's always more than one pilot in airliners. And as I said, they have a better education and better training than car drivers. But also the aircraft as such, the aerodynamic thing that flies, needs to continue flying. Right? In a car, in most situations, you'll be able to stop by the side of the road and take a good look at what has gone wrong. But the airplane at least has to go on to the next suitable airport. So who has seen this before? Is anyone into car automation? Okay, so the automobile industry has defined five, or rather six, levels of automation. Up until a few years ago, almost all cars were at level zero. So the dumb systems that we have, like simple cruise control, ABS, things like that, they don't really count. But then we have some simple automation systems like adaptive cruise control, lane change assist, things like that, self-parking cars. Because in most of these systems, the driver still has to operate the accelerator and the brake, and the car will only turn the steering wheel. So that's a one-dimensional assistance function or automated function. And all the cars that today say they can drive autonomously and that are sold to customers are at level two, no more than that today. There are some level four cars in testing. There's no level five car in testing yet. In my estimate, it's going to take a long time until we see level five. There's some level four in testing, and most of it is level two. And as such, the Tesla Autopilot is actually aptly named because it operates on a level comparable to an aircraft autopilot. In a very specific domain, it can do some things autonomously, but if it has to do something else entirely, it hands control back to the driver. And that's what you saw on my title page, is the little, if you enable your autopilot on a Tesla, it shows this little blue box that says hold steering wheel. In fact, the Tesla autopilot will remain engaged if you remove your hands from the steering wheel for several minutes. It will go on driving if you don't touch the steering wheel. But if you do it for too long, eventually it will say, you didn't heed my advice to touch the steering wheel, so I will now disable the autopilot for the rest of the trip. So, there's some level four in testing, but how safe are current cars with automated driving features? We really can't tell. There have only been a very small number of accidents, and some manufacturers claim that they have driven N million kilometers. I think Waymo or Google, by any other name, said that they have now driven 4 million kilometers autonomously without driver intervention, or so they say, or they have to report every driver intervention, but in fact they don't report every driver intervention because they think that they don't need to report driver intervention if their simulations show that the automated system would have been able to cope, but the driver disabled it. So they say they don't need to report that because they could have done it with the automated system. Right? If you compare the statistics with manually driven cars, human driven cars, it's also a bit biased because practically all automated cars are new, or at most a few years old. So it's also may have something to do with the state of repair and how careful drivers are with their new toy. So, and most of the miles or kilometers driven with the automated systems enabled will have been on highways and overland, and much less in the city, and cities much more challenging. So, and it's going to be a long time until cars can completely autonomously drive through city traffic. Don't know if you've ever driven in Rome, that's apparently extremely challenging, right? So how safe are they going to be in the future? Well, we really don't know either, obviously. The next levels to try to achieve will be 3 and 4. As I said, there are some level 4 cars in testing. Level 4 means in a very specifically defined environment, for example, on a highway, the car can drive autonomously, and the driver is not required to supervise the automatic system. And in level 4, it also means there is an automated fallback system, which at least can bring the car into what is called a minimum risk state, which almost always will be driving to the side of the road and stopping. Right? So if the car knows that it's coming to the exit, to the intersection, at which the defined environment in which it is supposed to operate will end, it will alert the driver, saying, oh, it's time for you to take over in 10 seconds or in 15 seconds or whatever. And in level 3, the driver must take over then. That is part of the derived requirements, so to speak, for the driver. So it's one assumption on level 3 that the driver will be ready to take over after a request for intervention. They use lots of strangely defined terms in the SAE document. And the capabilities of the normal automated systems for level 3 and level 4 are basically the same. But level 3 works on the assumption that the driver is ready to take over after a brief warning time. And level 4 has no such requirement and says level 4, if my domain of operation ends, I have a special routine that will allow me to put the car in the minimum risk state, which may be just stopping on by the side of the road or something like that. So most people I've talked to in the automotive industry say that level 3 is unachievable in practice. We will not do level 3, we will do level 4. Because you can't really work on that assumption. It will be very hard to prove that the driver will always be ready to take over, because while the car is driving in level 3 under full automated control, the driver is allowed to do something else. Can watch a movie or play cards with his passenger or whatever, but needs to be able to take over after some time. And the other thing is that how long before the actual required takeover does the car have to tell the driver? It's not specified, but a general assumption seems to be on the order of 15 seconds. And if you go on 150 kilometers on the highway, 15 seconds covers a lot of distance. So the car will need to have the ability to look into the future and look around a bend maybe. So that's all really the consensus seems to be, that level 3 doesn't work in practice. So basically that's just what I said. So let's briefly talk about level 5. Level 5 is really, from science fiction movies, the car that has no driver, probably doesn't even have a steering wheel or anything, it's just a cab. You get on it, it drives you where you want to go, and the SAE level 5 really stipulates that it has to be able to do so everywhere, under any road conditions, under any weather conditions. There's a small caveat there. It says that it needn't be able to do the complete trip under conditions in which a human driver could also not drive at all, or when it really can't get any information about its surroundings, for example, in a blizzard, something like that. That is the exception for that. But other than that, dry weather, rain, storm, fog, all conditions, and that's really full level 5. And we don't really see that achievable in the near future. Maybe someday. So how safe do cars need to be? And this is from an actual industry standard. The tolerable risk is the risk that, based on current societal values, will be accepted in a given condition. So it's very, very vague, and it's going to be a huge problem if we're going to develop self-driving or autonomous cars that we're going to sell all over the world, because this actually depends a lot on the society on which you're going to sell them. So there may be societies which accept much lower standards of safety, as long as they are better than current human driver performance. Or in some countries, they may have to be a lot better than human drivers before we're going to accept them. But it's going to be hard to measure current societal values. And one other thing is that traditionally for safety critical systems, we have been doing formal requirements and a formal design specification, formal verification if possible, such as the flight control system, fly-by-wire control system on airliners, or even more so on fast jets, because fast fighter jets are aerodynamically unstable, and if the flight control fails, it will literally rip the wings off within 200 milliseconds or something like that. So that has to work at all times. There's no way around that. For airliners, it's not quite as critical. They'll fly stably for maybe half a minute or so before it starts decaying, but they'll continue to fly more or less. And for self-driving cars, we don't even really know what the requirements are. And the environment in which they are going to operate is so complex that the only chance that all manufacturers see is deep learning, by any other name, artificial intelligence, whatever you may call it, CNNs, whatever. And you can't objectively verify that the code and all the parameters actually fulfill the requirements. And, well, we don't have requirements anyway, so there are probably some border conditions which we have to fulfill for safe operation. But proving that a neural network will actually fulfill those is an unsolved problem. So Tesla already said that in their latest software version, not a single line of code will have been written by a human. There's just the basic machine learning structure, and everything that the car is going to do is done by machine learning. It's quite likely that automated cars will be a lot safer than human drivers on average. Quite a bit, actually, if it's done right. But there will be accidents caused by automated driving systems that a human would not have done, that could have been prevented by a human. And that's going to be one of the big obstacles to acceptance, I think. Even if we're going to save 10 hypothetical unspecified people somewhere, won't be a big consolation if a relative of me is being killed by a self-driving car. And I have no idea to predict how how the societal values will evolve around this. So it's really hard to tell. Maybe just a little bit better will already be accepted by the society in general. And I think the press is going to play a big role in that, in the acceptance or not for that, but we'll see how it works out. It's going to be an exciting future. Thank you very much. Do you use the microphone for questions or? Are there any? Can't hear you. Are there any questions?
In English? I a little bit miss the beginning. I guess you are a pilot. Or in this direction?
A private pilot, yeah.
I don't know how many of you heard in Japan there will be there will be automated taxi service. Can you know this?
Do you know air taxis?
Like? Air taxis, maybe. So my question is, in Japan they are crazy for the technology. In which level from these six this taxi service is? Is that just on the rail, or is it on a special?
If it's on a rail, the automotive levels don't really apply. But something that's running on a rail, driverless, is probably going to be level 4, right?
I mean, you know the service, taxi service, what the Japan use?
No, not exactly.
In 2020 there will be Olympic Games or something, and they want to use maximum automated cars.
Mm-hmm. So but on a they're going to run on a rail, or I don't know. I don't know that system. So. No. No more questions. Oh yes.
What about emergency cars, for example, police or the firefighters? Is there maybe a driver assistance system or automatic driving for the emergency drive or something like that planned in the future?
No, not that I know of. But,
Okay. Well,
yeah. Go ahead.
Okay, if there is no defined way to predict the behavior of a program, are there any ideas how you could reliably verify the performance of a self-learning network?
That's the big question, right? So, one idea is that. There's a wrapper around it which limits certain parameters to probably safe bounds, but how exactly that is going to work is still not quite clear. And it's also very hard to do that, because if you can make a verifiable program safe, then you're probably going to restrict the deep learning algorithms too far, and they can't really work to their full potential. So the short answer is no, we don't know how to do that beyond extremely long testing and living with the occasional crash. Yeah.
Boom, boom. Oh, yes, thank you very much for the presentation. What is your take on when something happens in a plane, or today a car crashes, there is some legal liability? So usually somebody goes to jail. When an autonomous vehicle crashes or kills somebody these days, it's kind of like nobody's fault. Maybe the company pays some, you know, reparations, but that's about it. Pretty much there is nowhere near the amount of actual human liability involved in autonomous driving today. Do you see this changing?
Yeah, I could have talked about that for another hour, I guess. But normally the first liability is to the driver. Okay, so we don't have a driver. Then it's probably the manufacturer who's liable. But I don't know that, that anything like that has happened yet or has gone to the courts yet, so we don't really know. There will probably be something like, not exactly a certification, but you need to prove to the legislator that the car that you're bringing to market is somehow not going to harm people. And that's part of European legislation. So the first one liable will be the manufacturer, but how that plays out in practice in the courts, I don't know.
Hello. I'm sorry, I missed maybe the first 5 or 10 minutes. Please tell me, you mentioned IEC 61508.
Yeah.
So on the other hand, there's ISO 26262, the automotive standard for cars like up to 3.5 tons. The difference between the two standards is like that the ISO 22, the automotive standard is very specific on each phase of developing a vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
So are you somehow familiar what's going on, how they want to specify this whole, let's call it automation paradox that currently just pushing to the market? Because they want to outsource anything, right? So they want to be very specific with their OEMs. So I think like they're trying to create facts before they had actually a standard for this, right?
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be very interesting, but I'm not really familiar with the 26262, so can't tell you anything, but I'm sure they're meeting and trying to incorporate that into the standard. But if I know anything about standardization meetings, it's going to take a long time. So any more questions? Okay then, well, thank you very much for listening. And